You found the Diggin' Oak Island podcast, a podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride, and I thank you for downloading and listening. With the new season of The Curse of Oak Island debuting Tuesday, November 5th on the History Channel, I thought for the next couple episodes, we would turn our attention to the show and get ready for the new season by looking back to last year, doing a little review of Season 6 of The Curse of Oak Island. To say the least, The Curse of Oak Island had some big shoes to fill when Season 6 debuted on November 13th of 2018, because Season 5 from 2017 was not only just a huge success for the show, but was also a seminal year, a year of discovery in the history of the Oak Island treasure hunt. If you recall, Season 5 was the season of the cross, so to speak. It was the year Gary Drayton pulled a centuries-old lead cross out from under a rock on Smith's Cove, an amazing and confounding discovery that stands as one of the great artifacts ever found on Oak Island. That wasn't the only incredible find of 2017. Season 5 was also the season when the team found fragments of human bones within the spoils of a borehole called H8. They were small chips off bones from two different people, one probably of European descent, while the other likely Middle Eastern, and both dating to the late 1600s or early 1700s. While that information is fascinating for sure and offers amazing clues as to who might have been on the island and when, just the simple fact that human bones would be found over 160 feet underground is in itself really totally confounding. Needless to say, skeptics had a hard time with this one. And on top of those two incredible finds, the Oak Island search team also found, among other things, centuries-old garnet brooch, pieces of leather, perhaps from bookbinding, a small bit of parchment, and British coins dating from the late 17th century. It was an amazing collection of clues that really and truly offer more questions than answers, as the Laginas like to say, about the true history of Oak Island. So with all that in mind, and also the growing popularity of the show coming off such a successful season, the producers of The Curse of Oak Island responded with the longest season ever. It was a 22-episode marathon that extended from November 2018 until the end of April 2019, and also saw the airing of 6 episodes of the companion show Drilling Down, also more than ever before, one of which will really leave watchers with a postseason cliffhanger that's sure to dominate this upcoming season. On the searcher side of things, the Laginas and their team responded with what was easily the most expensive and most aggressive search plan they ever executed, and perhaps the biggest and most expensive in the 200-plus-year history of the dig. They built an absolutely enormous cofferdam, which had to cost, way into the millions of dollars. And that was to enable them to excavate all of Smith's Cove. They also dug more exploratory holes in the Money Pit area and searched to find the, in a search to find the original treasure shaft, which has been lost for decades. And they even let loose metal-detecting celebrity Gary Drayton, allowing him to sort of blanket the island with his detector, including searching places and areas not yet explored by this current team of searchers, and some not explored in many, many years. The Laginas and their partners definitely live the axiom, go big or go home, in Season 6, and came up with another fantastic collection of discoveries and artifacts. The plan they came up with was to focus on what Rick Lagina called the Big Three. And those three are Smith's Cove, the Money Pit, and the Swamp. All three will prove to be huge areas of interest in Season 6, but the search also extended beyond those, and more clues were unearthed. My original thought when planning this review of Season 6 was to go through and recap each episode kind of in order. And with that in mind, I really just finished spending hours and hours rewatching the entire season, taking comprehensive notes every step along the way. But it occurred to me after concluding the final episode and looking back over my pages and pages and pages and pages of notes that maybe such a podcast or podcast would not only be incredibly long, it also runs the risk of being incredibly boring. Last season is available on demand from the History Channel and from other outlets. So if you really want a play-by-play recap, or if you haven't seen it yet, I do recommend watching it yourself. But if you don't have the 24-plus hours or so to watch reruns, hopefully these next two podcast episodes will do the job and get you ready. So here's my plan. I'm going to go through all of the significant projects, the finds, and really all the accomplishments from last year, including the most important artifacts found, as well as information and theories discussed about them. Often when the team discovers something or starts to dig a shaft, that storyline of that particular item will spread over multiple shows. And even though I suppose that might be better from the angle of an overall narrative arc of the show, so to speak, it can make it difficult for viewers to keep all this information straight and follow it to its conclusion. So I thought if we can focus on the team's work with a bit more clarity, hopefully it will give everyone listening the knowledge you need to be ready, really ready, for the upcoming season. As watchers of the show already know, the narrator and even the cast often refer back to the work done in previous years and the discoveries and new information associated with that work. Now, in the interest of time and my desire to want to analyze things a bit and not just repeat what happened last season, I'm going to, like I said, divide this into two podcasts. This one will be about the major projects, the big three, as I mentioned earlier. And the next show will be about the most important artifacts kind of discovered last year that, you know, essentially weren't in the big three. So let's get started, shall we? Now, before we begin, let me just say that I'm not someone who pays much attention to ratings. In fact, I pay literally no attention to ratings at all for anything I watch. Before season 6 aired, I really had no idea if The Curse of Oak Island was doing well in that regard. But the first hint I got that perhaps the show was indeed a hit and maybe around for quite some time was when I saw that not only did the History Channel have 22 episodes planned, but also the debut was scheduled to be a 2-hour-long show. The season begins with two brothers, Rick and Marty Lagina, driving to Oak Island to begin another season of searching. They arrive at their new war room, built in a more secluded area of the island due to the increasing tourist presence there, perhaps another hint that the show is doing well. And inside is waiting the cast. Now, cast is a word most reality shows hate to use, but one that's certainly helpful to describe the quote-unquote stars of the show. We'll use cast. We'll also probably more likely use team or dig team, something along those lines. Around the table is seated Marty's business partner, Craig Tester, Craig's son, Jack Begley, veteran Oak Island treasure hunter, Dan Blankenship, and his son, Dave, Dan's decades-long friend and co-worker, Dan Henske, metal detection extraordinaire, Gary Drayton, researchers, Doug Crowell and Charles Barkhouse, and also archaeologist, Laird Niven. And this is where Rick coins the phrase, the big three, naming the Money Pit, the Swamp, and Smith's Cove as the main targets for the year's activity. So let's talk about those three places and the techniques used last season to search there. And let's begin with the Money Pit. One question I get a lot from people who are only kind of casual watchers of the show are, why are they digging so many holes? It's a good question when you think about it. What everyone watching knows is there was an initial hole dug 200 years ago where searchers pulled up oak planks. It seemed to be human placed at 10-foot intervals, a large collection of coconut fiber. It doesn't belong there, and strange inscribed stone. Decades later, searchers found pieces of gold chain, evidence of a wood vault or chest, and more, all in the same hole. This was stopped by an apparent booby-trap flood tunnel system. But we at least know that what we're looking for is down that hole, right? I mean, let's just use modern technology and methods to try to get down to the bottom of that one hole. Doesn't that make sense? Well, yeah, it does. But the problem is, no one knows anymore exactly where that hole really is. And that's a confounding part of the search, and one that the show doesn't always do a great job of explaining or pointing out. The fact is, the Laginas would love nothing more than to dig on the Money Pit and focus their attention on solving the Money Pit's complex booby trap system and get to that supposed treasure vault at the bottom. But first, they have to find where that pit really is. And people have been trying to do that for decades. So one of the things you'll come to learn about the 200 plus year history of Oak Island's treasure hunt is that the folks searching there, for many reasons, just didn't keep good records of where exactly they worked and what exactly they did. People listening to previous episodes of this show should already be very familiar with the sketchy at best records we have to go on now. For decades, research, and I don't mean researching potential theories of the treasure or who might have put it there, but researching the history of the dig itself has been as much a part of this process as the actual process of digging has been. Now add to that the dozens and dozens of holes already dug into this area. some in search of the money pit and others in search of alternative ways into the treasure area or vault, so to speak. And you have this sort of jumbled mess of land that becomes more and more impossible to keep track of. These days, we have the technology, using GPS and such, to keep incredibly accurate records of where exactly work is being done, down to within inches in many cases. But that technology came in long after the money pit was lost. Many, many educated guesses have been made. Many have researched past attempts, looked at maps of the island's workings, surveys, referenced years of information before digging, and had total confidence in their decisions on where to dig, but none of them have been successful. In a relatively short time that Laginas have been on the island, they've tried multiple times to find the money pit, only to fail. So now you see why Rick Lagina calls the money pit one of the big three. He isn't really referring to getting at the treasure to the bottom of the pit as much as he's referring to finding the money pit itself. 2018 saw the arrival of new technology in search of the money pit, a process called seismic scanning, or I think it's also referred to as reflection seismology. And it's being performed by a company out of Calgary called Eagle Canada. The process seems kind of simple, at least to understand. Dynamite is ignited into the ground, causing a shock wave down into the ground, and those waves are being read by a device called a geophone, which turns the waves, the returning waves, into data about what lies beneath. It reminds me kind of a lot of sonar, just for the under the ground. And as a test, the dig team directs Eagle Canada to perform their scanning in an area where they know what to expect the data to say. It is an area where the so-called Halifax Tunnel is located, and you hear them mention this a couple of times. The tunnel is named after a search group from the late 1860s called the Halifax Company. It was also referred to as the Oak Island El Dorado Company. And they are believed to have built this tunnel in an attempt to enter the money pit from a different angle and avoid the floodwater trap. A lot of people tried this. Eagle Canada sets off a bunch of these charges, and the data is read exactly the way the Laginas and Craig Test are expected to, leading them to sort of have faith in this process and give Eagle Canada the green light to scan the rest of the money pit area. By the time we get to episode 3, the results are in. The team heads to Calgary to meet with Eagle Canada and hear what they have to say. Now, the data can be confusing for sure. It's a picture of kind of colors and wavy shapes that are more kind of interpreted, really, than read. Meaning it's not like the show, like they show us a snapshot of what's below. It's not like it's a 3D model of what we could find down there. They're essentially measuring density. And the ground is filled with different things like rock, sand, clay. Under here, we're talking about more than that. Keep in mind, centuries worth of digging, building shafts, destroying shafts, and so on, must have the earth around the money pit looking like some sort of geological and archaeological jambalaya. I guess I was hoping this test would kind of give us a better idea of the location of things like wooden beams or collection of sort of unnatural debris and the like, but it really doesn't. And of course, I say that without hearing more from Eagle Canada and not really being allowed the chance to look more closely at the data myself. Having said that, the jumbled look of these results might just be the confirmation that really any chamber or vault built before 1795 has long since collapsed and been destroyed by treasure hunters digging dozens and dozens of holes. So let me stop for a second and say that really any discussion of work done at the money pit needs to be accompanied by information about a treasure hunter named Robert Dunfield. Dunfield came to the island after the Restall tragedy in 1965 and took over the hunt. Among other things, Dunfield decided to dig what can only be described as an enormous crater. It was a hole in the money pit area extending like 100 feet wide and 140 feet deep. Now think about that for a second. He essentially destroyed everything around the entire area you see now referred to as the money pit area. And then he filled it all back in when things weren't going well and really never completed the job. Now, we'll spend more time in future episodes, I'm sure, talking about Dunfield. But I think the kind of destruction he reaped in the money pit area is something really everyone needs to keep in mind when thinking about and watching the current work being done there. Now, Eagle Canada focuses on three anomalies, as they call them. One is the huge 175-foot-long possible chamber in an area called the Mega Bin. Now, the Mega Bin is an area a few hundred feet north of the Money Pit where Dan Blankenship dug dozens and dozens of little boreholes in search of tunnels or something. There is a lot to talk about in this area and what Dan might have found there, but we would come to find a few episodes later that this anomaly was really nothing more than an area of sand that was at a sort of a different density than the surrounding dirt and rocks. The most interesting thing about the mega bin stuff was how it kind of exposed the limitations of the seismic data. What they thought was a chamber was really just something at kind of a different density or a looser bit of sand, made them think that this was possibly a chamber. So the team drills exploratory holes on the other two seismic anomalies. Most of it leads nowhere, but one exploratory hole makes them believe that they might be on to what they call Shaft 6. Now, Shaft 6 is an oldie. It goes back to 1850 and was dug by the Truro Company. It was another one of these attempts to reach the treasure by avoiding the flood tunnel in the money pit and tunneling into the area where they thought the vault was from a different area, from a different angle. It supposedly got very, very close before it flooded and then possibly led to a collapse of the money pit itself. So finding Shaft 6 could really be the key to finding the money pit's location. Now, why did I mention Robert Dunfield before? Well, Shaft 6 is a great example of why. If we accept that Dunfield did in fact crater out the entire area to a depth of 140 feet, which we have pictures, well, Shaft 6 was dug at a depth of 118 feet. You do the math. Much of the rest of the season's work on the Money Pit revolves around the search for Shaft 6. They drill more than one hole trying to find it, often bringing up huge timbers and a variety of smaller artifacts like pottery and such, but they never seem to find the actual path of Shaft 6. More likely, they are finding a debris field created by either the Money Pit collapse or later searchers, as we mentioned. This brings us to the saga of borehole H8, which you will remember as the borehole where some very interesting artifacts were unearthed, including human bones. The work ended on H8 in the previous season with the hypothesis that the caisson, or this big giant can they put in, pushed the chapel vault out of the way rather than breaking through it. Okay, what's the chapel vault? Great question. In the 1890s, the Oak Island Treasure Company, whose drilling was led by a man named Chapel, and it was on one of those drill bits that penetrated the vault where a piece of parchment with the letters VI was found. You've seen that piece of parchment all the time on the show. So it's easy to see why this chapel vault would be the target. The team wants to clear the caisson with the hammer grab. Essentially, they're putting in this kind of big hand that goes in and grabs up all the dirt and yanks it up and takes it out. And they're hoping that after they do that, they can lift the caisson up and the vault will fall back into place. In episode 13, Jack Begley finds in the hammer grab spoils, the stuff brought out, that what he believes to be another small piece of parchment with this reddish pink marking on it. Joe Landry, an expert in old books who teaches on the subject in Halifax, says that the pigment looks and the paper as well really seem to indicate an origin dating back to maybe even the Renaissance. Another cool little aspect of H8 involves another of these technological hiccups that are so often mentioned as part of the Oak Island's supernatural ability to hide its secrets. After they cleared the H8 shaft with the hammer grab, they put a remote-operated vehicle, what we call an ROV, down the hole with a sonar attached. It's kind of a little submarine, a little remote-control submarine. And the immediate results show an interesting glimpse at a right angle of some sort, like something in the edges of whatever's down there that shows a right angle. Now, nature doesn't often make right angles, so it seemed man-made. But then the ROV started to take on water, and the entire process failed. They never really went back to it because a short time later, a cave-in or a sinkhole developed around the H8 shaft, and that brought all this work kind of to a halt. One more shaft they began digging in search of the original money pit is called Site 3. During the hammer grab in this shaft, the team finds that just beyond a depth of 100 feet, some more really big hand-cut timbers and even some oak beams, which they think might be from the original money pit itself. So maybe they're getting close, but as we explained, at this depth, it's impossible really to know. In the spoils of Site 3, the team finds some more pottery, an interesting piece of wood that does look like it was dyed purple for some reason. But before they could do more looking, a machine worker's strike essentially brings the season's work on the money pit to a close. Now, an interesting sidebar for the Money Pit involves a gyroscope technology expert named Tony Martin. Mr. Martin he's tested the accuracy. His job was to test the accuracy of the dig team's exploratory holes, basically seeing how straight they are, and found that really one of them deviated by something like 5 feet off where they started. Meaning by the time the hole got to the bottom, it was in a place, you know, feet away from where they thought it was. Craig Tester recognizes how disappointing that actually is, but while walking around the island, Martin finds a really strange-looking rock that looks hand-cut and inscribed with some very strange, almost runic-looking characters, which admittedly might have weathered significantly since it was really fully exposed to the elements. They bring in a company called Azimuth to use LIDAR, which is laser-based technology that can scan and take hyper-accurate readings of any surface. And they scan the stone, send the images of it and the LIDAR results to a Dr. Lila Kopar at Catholic University in Washington, D.C. I hope I'm saying her name right. The doctor concludes that it is definitely not runic script, but might possibly be a medieval Gothic script. Now, while I see the similarities because I looked at what she was talking about, I had to admit it's hard to be sure about this one. However, the stone is fascinating on many levels. Kopar and Oak Island's resident geologist Terry Matheson both agree that it appears to be sort of architectural. And it's also incredible that it was found totally exposed and so close to the money pit. I mean, how many searchers must have walked right past it over the years? Very weird. While the work at the Money Pit was certainly extensive, it really pales in comparison to what the Oak Island dig team did at Smith's Cove last summer, the man-made beach that has long been identified as the source of the booby-trap flood tunnel system. Well, some people think it's not the only source, but I digress. The aforementioned cofferdam they built to keep the ocean out of Smith's Cove is certainly not the first one ever built there, and not even the first the Laguna's tried to build. But it's most certainly the biggest, most expensive, and seems to be the most effective. After building a road and a huge concrete crane pad to bring in the heavy equipment, the contractors leave them with an absolutely mind-blowing structure that certainly does the job. They also purchase a wash plant. Watchers of Gold Rush will know what that is. This is a huge mechanical beast that is used to wash and separate pieces of rock and earth into separate size and weight-specific piles. So if you're mining for gold, what you do is you take the dirt from the ground and drop it into one of these wash plants. The plant then washes it off, shakes it up, separates all the big rocks and dirt from what might be a gold nugget. So keep in mind, Smith's Cove is where the medieval cross was found. The team here is now, you know, using this because they expect and are hoping, really, to find more of these small artifacts. So the plant kind of makes sense. Truth be told, though, it doesn't seem to bear much fruit. Not this past year, but you never know what the future might bring. So with the cove essentially dried out and the dirt below the water exposed, it's time to start excavating. Now, describing the work done last year in Smith's Cove in an audio podcast format is difficult. The structures they unearth can almost be, like impossible to really describe or relay just in this format. But I'll do the best I can. A lot of what the team is looking to expose is really already known. They know what they're going after. Dan Blankenship, among others, did a lot of work here, and Dan documented and photographed much of it, but didn't have the resources to build a cofferdam like the Laguna's did. So after Dan removes his cofferdam, the ocean comes back and this stuff is forever buried as dirt and silt and all that stuff gets pushed by the ocean up onto the beach. First thing the team targeted in Smith's Cove is called the U-shaped structure. No search team ever documented it, so exposing it might offer clues to who did the work. And what I mean there is Dan Blankenship documented finding it, but no search team before documented building it. So what they want to do is open it up and see it again, and maybe that can give them some idea of who did the work, to hide the treasure, who the team often refer to as, this is the kind of work we refer to as original or quote-unquote depositors, that kind of thing. There are some very peculiar aspects of this structure. For one, the long beams are marked with clearly hand-carved Roman numerals. But even weirder is that there's no metal fasteners of any kind. This is something that archaeologist Laird Niven points out. There's no nails, there's no spikes, there's nothing. That would seem to indicate kind of a primitive construction, or maybe even that it was done by somebody without access to, you know, building supplies, metal supplies. Just beyond the U-shaped structure is something they called the L-shaped structure. The team also uncovers a strange, undocumented wood wall inside the U-shaped structure. All three are out by the new cofferdam, and to be honest, they all look like, really, early attempts at cofferdams themselves. There's also evidence of trying to seal between the boards and that kind of thing. Could they just be work done by early treasure hunters that just nobody bothered to document? Well, we shall see. Even further out, just in front of the cofferdam, the team uncovers a concrete wall that has two pipes right next to it. Each, they're right next to each other, a weird place to put them, and they're plugged by rubber. While strange, this is clearly modern and built by searchers, and this is a great example of how frustrating the history of the work done on the island can be. No one on the team, and these are guys who have dedicated years to researching the subject, years, no one has any idea why this wall is here or who built it. Even though it's clearly built by one of the treasure hunters, none of those treasure hunters ever bothered to write down that they built a giant concrete wall to try to dam up Smith's Cove. It's incredible. Rick says at one point that people were so obsessed with finding the treasure that, quote, recording data was not an imperative, unquote. I mean, this is a constant fight for the team and for us, and really shines a light on everything like this they find. Just because we don't know who might have built it, and I mean anything found on the island, it does not by any means suggest this is original or part of the work done to deposit whatever's deposited there. You got to keep that in mind. So even though the U-shaped structure and the L-shaped structure and a lot of other things we're about to find are not documented, that does not mean they're not done by treasure hunters, as this concrete wall with these pipes and rubber in them clearly indicates this would not have been done before 1795. In episode 15, the team conducts a dye test in hopes of finding the source of the flood tunnels that booby-trap the money pit. They pour a red dye into a shaft near the money pit while pumping water in and searching for where that dye comes out. After all, it is salt water, so it leads to the ocean somewhere. Gary Drayton finds it trickling out in Smith's Cove, so the team begins to dig towards the shore, looking towards the, you know, toward the island itself, looking to find and hopefully follow the flood tunnel towards what they call the convergence point. The theory here is that there are five separate finger drains that spread out into Smith's Cove, and those drains all converge somewhere before then heading down in one big giant drain towards the money pit, or towards the treasure shaft or the treasure vault or whatever might be there. Now, many searchers have tried to find that spot and plug it up. To me, this explains a lot of what they find in this area of the cove. We do know for certain that many previous treasure hunters drove wood planks, big ones, they've described this, into the ground on the beach to try and stop the flooding. And that really seems to be what they're finding here. A lot of these flat boards and this kind of stuff, there's one that they actually unearthed that is a flat board that with a triangular end. To me, this really looks like an attempt to plug these, you know, potential drain tunnels or flood tunnels. The most interesting thing unearthed in Smith's Cove is undoubtedly, at least to me, the wharf, or what's probably better called a slipway. What we have here is essentially round wooden cross beams sitting on long planks extending into the sea. It looks like a wharf, but inexplicably, the cross beams are not fastened down at all. So imagine trying to walk on such a surface. It really only makes sense that this would be used to allow something very heavy to roll out into an ocean, something like a large boat, a boat ramp, or a slipway. I mean, to my eyes, this is a primitive, yet pretty ingenious boat launch. The guys think it might be used to drag something out of the water onto the beach, and I guess that could be true, but it certainly seems that gravity would make the opposite more likely and certainly more effective. taking something from the beach and dragging it out into the sea, because it does plane down. Now, it is easy to see how any of this, the slipway, the U-shaped structure, the various wooden walls, etc., could be built and used by searchers, people, treasure hunters. It all kind of makes sense. But the team sends some of the wood from these structures to be dated using something called dendrochronology. It's a process of using the tree rings to date wood, or at least date when the wood was chopped down. The dating places the U-shape at 1769 and the slipway at 1771, both more than two decades before the discovery of the money pit. Now, like I said, the test shows when it was chopped down, not when it was built. But I have a hard time figuring a way searchers would use 20-plus-year-old wood to build these things. But there is something else I don't understand. If this was built by the original depositors of the treasure, then how does the cross fit in? The cross we found here on this cove. We have workings from the 18th century, but artifacts from the 15th or before? And this area of Nova Scotia was inhabited by 1771. In fact, the land and the island was already private property. Yet no one saw a slipway or a cofferdam being built? And why would 18th century builders not use spikes or nails? Again, a lot of lots and lots and lots of questions, more questions. Another great piece of corroborating evidence for this 18th century timeline is a hinge and I think he called it a grip spike or something like that, found in the cove by Gary Drayton, another spike. And experts date the crib spike. That was the word I'm looking for. Experts date the crib spike from 1650 to about 1800. This is a blacksmith expert. And he says the hinge, which would have been used for what he calls a really big door. And I mean like really big. He says this is also pre-1800. The work at Smith's Cove was, in my opinion, really a huge success and fascinating for us. Although it certainly did not solve the riddle, it still remained really fascinating. The team wanted to bring to light what was under the water in the cove, something previous searchers never really could do, not for any length of time. And Lagunas did it. And now we have an even more fascinating angles and questions and things to discuss about Smith's Cove. And while we have some nice grainy pictures of these structures from the past, we now have HD quality video of all this stuff they did. So, you know, in the end, I think Smith's Cove really was, like I said, a huge success. So now let's turn our attention to the swamp. Now, Rick may have called it one of the big three in episode one, but it's really not until the end of the season that any, you know, significant work is done at the swamp. And it's not until after a week after the season finale that the swamp becomes the place we are all salivating over for this upcoming season. The team decides late in the year to bring Eagle Canada back to Oak Island to do some seismic testing of the swamp. We see the test being done in episode 21, and in a postseason episode of the Drilling Down show hosted by Maddie Blake, which airs on May 7th, we see the results of the test. And honestly, these results are perhaps the best cliffhanger that this show has ever produced. The team meets with Blake at an office in Traverse City, Michigan, what they call the original war room. Before the Eagle Canada reps enter the room, Blake asks everyone what their thoughts are before hearing the results. And I particularly love Alex Lagina's response. He points out that historically, this kind of data for the team is often tantalizing, quote, tantalizing, but not conclusive, unquote. I really feel like Alex is speaking for all of us here in pointing this out. We've so often been teased into thinking the next big thing is going to be found in the latest round of test results, only for the searchers to then start digging and come up with nothing. Eagle Canada comes in, and Alex Gauthier, which I think I'm saying that right, and geophysicist Jeremy Church do the talking. When Rick Lagina asks Gauthier what his excitement level is from 1 to 10, he answers 11. I mean, this guy already knows how to endear himself with the showrunners and creators, doesn't he? I mean, He enjoys the drama. The first anomaly Eagle Canada presents is a couple of anomalies they together refer to as the Highland Anomalies. And by Highland, he's referring to an area just off the swamp to the east, to the right, if you're looking at an aerial photo or a map, that's the Money Pit side of the swamp. Speaking in terms of topography, the swamp is pretty much, I think, the lowest altitude land on the island, and really just above sea level. On both sides of the swamp, the land kind of slopes up slightly. I mean, if you look at the island, this is the kind of the cool thing. If you look at the island from a certain angle, it really does look like two separate islands with like maybe a small channel going in between them. And we'll get to that more in a bit. There are two important Highland anomalies, and the data here is very tough for someone to read themselves who doesn't really know what they're looking at. I mentioned this before when Eagle Canada presented their Money Pit findings early in the season, and it's the same thing here. We really have to depend on the limited analysis offered by the show's narrator and cast, and that can be unsettling for someone trying to come up with an opinion independent of what the showrunners want us to think. Just for note, I've tried getting Eagle Canada on the show. They have not responded, or certainly have not responded positively. I'm going to continue to try. The first anomaly is described by Church as looking like, quote, a door to a stairs to a basement, end quote. And then another, which they call the, quote, unquote, connector anomaly. That seems to be a passage, or at least some kind of connection from these Highland areas straight towards the Money Pit area. Now, these are fascinating for sure, but it's time. But the next item they talk about is this is the big one. They call it the Swamp Anomaly. It's an area right smack in the middle of the swamp that, well, for lack of a better term, from this, looks like a ship buried underground. It really does. It's 200 feet long and is about 25 feet thick on the north side and 45 feet on the south side. It does look like someone sailed a 200-foot galleon from the south into that imaginary channel I just mentioned in between the two islands. The top of it sits just below sea level and goes down about 50 feet. If you do a quick search on galleons, you know, Spanish galleons and the like, you'll see that right away, those dimensions are just about right on. Church then describes the data, saying it doesn't really look natural, and gives a number of reasons why he thinks that. Let me also mention that the way they present the data here is way more understandable than everything else Eagle Canada has presented on this show so far. It's kind of a 3D rendering that really gives you an idea of dimension and shape and truly makes the anomaly look bizarre and out of place. But I'm not a geophysicist, so I don't really know how to interpret it. Okay, let's stop for a second and explain the theory I think they're working with here. Once again, imagine Oak Island as two little islands with a channel in between. The best theory I can come up with here is the original depositors created a tunnel leading from the west side of the eastern island, the Money Pit Island, if you will, and dug a tunnel from that shoreline, the eastern shoreline, leading to the treasure. These guys then sailed their ship in between the islands, scuttle it, block off the entrance on both ends, the north and south ends, I guess fill it with dirt or something, or just hope that over time, it fills itself, and then thus creating the swamp. And in the process, hiding not only the ship underground, but also the entrance to this tunnel. All in a place where no one in their right mind would ever dig, and certainly have one hell of a time if they tried. That's the best I can do to describe what I think the theory being created here, or theory being worked with here. It's an old theory. Treasure hunter Fred Nolan, who passed away only a couple of years ago, believed that swamp hid a sunken and buried ship and maybe even held the key to this whole mystery. I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but it was that's kind of the way he put it. It appears that Nolan might not be all that far off. Nolan found what he determined were the scuppers of a ship in the swamp and even a piece of a mast. The Laginas found a really large plank there as well, and Gary Drayton pulled out what he thought was an old ship spike. So it all seems to fit, right? Well, not so fast. After the break, Matty Blake says emphatically, "That's a ship." But I want to back up a bit to something Church says before all of the excitement of the reveal of this swamp anomaly. He says, quote, "It can definitely still be something very natural," unquote. Now, the show left that in, even though there was absolutely zero mention of anything natural from that point on. But keep that in mind. And keep in mind Craig Tester's cautious response as well. Remember the mega bin we talked about. When we first heard these results, it was a 175-foot chamber that upon digging quickly became a 175-foot section of sand. Could this be something like that or some sort of natural phenomenon? We shall see. The show is here to make us excited to watch the next season. And I can't help but think about Gautier's response when he's talking about this anomaly. He throws in a line that says, "If you guys don't dig on it, we will," you know, which he says very matter-of-factly. So, you know, I believe everybody here, including myself, thinks this data is incredibly compelling. It certainly stands to reason the showrunners are doing everything they can to make it seem as compelling as possible. So keep that in mind. I'll be honest, despite the showrunner's desire to get me all jacked up about this anomaly being a buried ship, I simply could never get those words, "can definitely still be something very natural." Could never get those words out of my head, even when I first watched this episode. Now listen, I'm not in the prediction business here, but I really feel I would be stunned if this anomaly is not something natural. Sure, it's strange. It looks weird. And it looks like a ship. And it fits into things that we've heard in the past. But I really don't know why any potential natural explanations were never even discussed or thrown out there on the show. I hope they were in private, you know, or at least to the dig team. In order for Church to have said that, definitely still be something very natural. He must have had something in mind. As a viewer, I wish we could have heard what that something might have been. We saw already how a natural anomaly like the sand in the mega bin can be misread or blown up for dramatic effect. And I just hate to say this, but it's totally possible that's what's happening here too. Here's hoping I'm wrong. So that's it for this episode of Digging Oak Island. On the next episode, we'll conclude our Season 6 review by discussing many of the artifacts found by the team last year. So please stay tuned, stay subscribed for that. Having mentioned that, please subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you do enjoy the show, please rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen. That really does help to get the word out on the show, and I do appreciate it. You can also follow us on Facebook. We are at Diggin' Oak Island. Give us a like there. That would be much appreciated. It really is a kind of the best place for you to follow along what we're doing, to leave your comments on each show. You could ask any questions there, all that kind of stuff. It's sort of a great place to interact. We'll be doing some more social media as we go along, but right now just keeping it on Facebook just seems to be the best way to do it for the time being. If you have any other questions or comments that you want to send to me directly, rather than using Facebook, you can do so via email. I'm at digginoakisland@gmail.com. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride, and I thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.